You're on the panel, international. Welcome. Quite a few responses for Ella's suggestion where to go. Come to Cambridge for the Labor Day Quality Craft Fair at the White Church. Relax over a coffee. There are no politics here. Waihee Beach has an amazing cafe right on the sand. And come to the peaceful Maharangi West Regional Park. Stop at Puhoi on the way and spend your dollars an hour from Auckland, says Julie. Today on the program, onwards and upwards for Russ, says Judith Collins, we discuss with Professor Richard Shaw. And would you change your mind about renting or buying a property if you found out it was believed to have been haunted? Someone's just texted me, no way would I rent a known haunted house. So we discuss that later on in the program. I'm with Dr. Ella Henry, Associate Professor in Māori Entrepreneurship at AUT and former National Party MP and Archdeacon of Waitotara Chest Boroughs. First up, though, Tourism Aotearoa has floated the idea of a domestic travel card loaded with $200 for all New Zealanders as a way to help the struggling tourism sector. The card could only be used outside of weekends and school holidays. There's also support, industry support for Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern to take over the tourism portfolio in order to encourage overseas visitors to come to our shores once they are allowed to return. And Australian media cites the travel bubble may be about to pop just days into its operation. With us is Professor Simon Milne, Director of the New Zealand Tourism Research Institute. Professor Milne, welcome.
Yes, hi.
So it sounds, at first glance, a fairly nifty idea to give everyone a $200 tourism pop-up. What do you think?
Well, it's not the first example of this around the world. We've seen different countries introduce similar kinds of policies. I guess the question really is what's going to be in the detail of all of this. If $200 is a reasonable amount of money, and I guess the question would be how will that be distributed? And as you've mentioned, it may only be able to be used at certain times. In places like Italy, they've actually offered up to €500 in money to encourage people to stay in domestic accommodation. But they have means tested that. So if you earn more than about €40,000 a year, you're not able to access those funds. Iceland has got a similar program in place, has done for a while, but the amount that they hand out is around €33 per person, but you can actually combine that with others. So if you don't want to use it, you can pass it on to a family member or others, and that will obviously give them a little bit more money to play with. So I think it's an example of industries around the world being quite desperate to find ways to bolster that domestic spend.
What do you think about that idea, Ella, at first glance?
I think that, you know, the ability to give out the cash during the first lockdown made a huge difference to lots of people, and so something like this could do a similar kind of thing. It does seem, kind of expensive. It'd have to be at least $500 million set aside. So,
Major injection.
It's a major injection. And if you did have those controls, like people earning over a certain amount, not receiving one, that it had to be used. Although if you live in an isolated rural community and you can't use it on the weekends or holidays, it really only means you can go to the fish and chip shop.
Simon, stay with us, Simon. Chester, at a first glance, $200 into your bank account be used exclusively for local tourism, but not on the weekends.
Well, I think your $200 go a long way in South Taranaki, Ella. You get into the Elvis Presley Memorial Museum, the Tawhiti Museum, Stratford Pioneer Village.
There you go.
These are things I want to do.
yeah. Oh, no, we'll see you. We'll put you up. And then you can come to church on Sunday morning with me. No politics.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you.
Professor Milne, there are also calls for Jacinda Ardern to become the tourism minister. Look, is it a bit out there? I mean, is it too early to be talking about this? Or actually, is that quite a good idea, given the international reputation that she has?
Oh, I think it's a fantastic idea. In fact, I'd say it's a no-brainer, really. Her profile internationally, as you say, is unparalleled in terms of prime ministers that we've had. And she's got a real ability to connect with people and build relationships. So to me, that would be a fantastic approach. And I think, you know, tourism is not a poor cousin. It's a major part of our economy, and it's a part of our economy that we need to rebuild very soon. So I think she would be an ideal person to you know, take that forward.
Now, looking to Australia now, this one-way travel bubble is in place for New Zealanders heading to New South Wales and the Northern Territory, but it seems the rules have already been broken. People have been landing, New Zealanders have been landing and then shooting off into other jurisdictions. And I think someone was saying that in the Australian media that Kiwis haven't caught on because, you know, we're one jurisdiction here, they haven't caught on to the fact that the concept of Australia with internal state borders, which have a right to bar or restrict visitors, is alien to 99% of us. Is this travel bubble just getting a bit complicated? Is it working?
Well, I guess it's a matter of semantics, isn't it? But I would really struggle to call it a bubble. To me, a bubble is something in which you've got, you know, free-moving circulation. This to me, really looks like a one-way corridor. And certainly the early data that was presented by Air New Zealand showed that about 90% of the people flying were actually just taking a one-way ticket. So the bottom line is it's opened up Australia for those people in the country that want to travel there, and I think a lot of them will be travelling to visit friends and relatives or perhaps to return to Australia. And I guess, you know, from my perspective, what this shows is the strength of what we call the visiting friends and relatives market, the strength of people's desire to reconnect to family. But at the moment, I would say it's not a bubble that's going to last very long. I think it also highlights the issue of clear communication, because the Department of Health and Human Services website in Victoria does specifically say that New Zealanders can, once they've arrived in New South Wales, fly to Victoria, fly to Melbourne. So there are crosswinds, if you like, in terms of the messages that are being presented. And I think a lot of the Kiwis or people from New Zealand that have travelled would be arguing that they probably have followed the rules as they have read them at the moment.
Professor Simon Mill, thank you very much for your time there. But to that the second point there, someone's just reminded us, Chester Debbie says, reminded John Key as Prime Minister was the Minister for Tourism, so not the first time this would be the case. I guess that is something that, the tourism expert there says actually that would make a huge difference. What do you think?
Yeah. Oh, I think it certainly would. And we've got to remember that Jacinda's got experience of this. Remember, she brought the guy from Saturday Night Live, John something or other, over here and met him at the airport and drove him around.
Oh, that's right.
So, you know.
Who was that guy? Not Saturday Night.
John.
Late Night with.
Stephen Colbert.
Colbert.
Thank you, Flo.
Yeah, John someone. Yeah.
Yes, Stephen John Colbert.
That's right. It's 15 past four, the panel on RNZ National. Judith Collins arrived with a large group of MPs this afternoon to a press conference post-caucus meeting. Could have been almost all her MPs, actually, saying that the meeting was very constructive and it is now onwards and upwards for us.
We've had a very good caucus meeting where we have talked about the review that the National Party is undertaking into the last sort of term of government, of opposition, I should say, but also the campaign itself. And I've asked, and the caucus has agreed to be part of that review, and they will be undertaking meetings with our volunteers and voter base around various issues, and they'll be mostly listening, which we think is a great opportunity for us to reconnect, listen, and think about the way forward. We've been, I thought it was a very, very constructive caucus meeting, and I just really want to thank everyone for all of the contributions, which have been, I think, absolutely inspiring. So it's onwards and upwards for us, and we are determined to be the best opposition ever.
And Gerry Brownlee will be staying, as he said, there's a job to be done in Christchurch. National's caucus is trying to pick up the pieces at its first meeting following that defeat. And today the 21 casualties of the election were given the chance to say goodbye, leaving with a silver platter And, of course, there has been ongoing speculation that party leader Judith Collins' job is on the line. But as for now, the caucus appears united. So is it a matter of when, not if? Professor Richard Shaw from Massey University is with us. Professor Shaw, welcome.
Kia ora, Wallace. How are you?
Good, thank you. Look, how much of National's misfortunes is down to the leader herself, or were these external factors unrelated to her?
I think they're probably both of those things, Wallace. It's reasonably clear, I think, that there were a number of National Party people, or people who would, under other circumstances, have voted for National, people who did so in 2017, who shifted across to and gave their party vote to Labour. We don't know exactly how many of those people are at the moment. Some of those will have been driven away from the party, some by Collins' leadership, some from the dysfunctional goings-on within the party. Some have gone to Labour, but are really there because of Prime Minister Ardern rather than the Labour Party in particular. I don't think the National Party is saying this, but it cannot really say that it is simply a function of COVID or of Ardern. There are clearly factors within the party itself. They go to leadership, they go to the organisational culture of the party, the strategic direction taken by the board, perhaps problems with the ground operation. There's a whole range of things that the National Party will be looking at.
Right. Now, we'll bring our panellists in very shortly, but I can recall, Professor Shaw, you were on this very programme, actually just prior, I believe, to Judith Collins being elected as the leader, or being placed in as the leader, and you said that she will always be seen as a caretaker leader. Do you still believe that?
I think that she probably is, but only in one respect. I'm not sure that she will lead the party into the 2023 election, but neither would I necessarily rule that out at the moment. There has been some talk about somebody like John Luxon coming in, but John Luxon is a first-term MP. He doesn't know how to be an MP. He has had no ministerial experience. And so I think particularly given the decimation of National's ranks over the weekend, the calculus around the leadership changes. It would be, in some respects, the worst possible thing for them to change leaders again now, to have the fourth leader in almost as many months. Whoever the new person would have three former party leaders sitting behind them. That may be to that person's advantage or not, but it would certainly send the worst kind of message to the party faithful, those people who it has to bring back from the other side of the political aisle. What the Prime Minister will be doing is trying to convert those former National Party people into serial Labour voters. What the National Party has to do is to get them back by figuring out what kind of party it is, how it makes itself look like contemporary Aotearoa New Zealand rather than a group of people who are largely dominated by Pākehā men. And it needs to have a consistent, kind of stable leadership. So there is a job for Judith Collins to be done, I think, but the calculus around what is required of the leader after this election result is quite different to that which applied before the election.
Okay, right. Or let's bring in our panel and first with Chester Burrows, who actually was part of National for some years. Now, Chester, your thoughts on what Richard said and beyond?
I think Richard made some really good points. That I was a candidate in 2002, which was, you know, a horrific election for National, and the last time that they ran such a review like this, and it had some significant change within the party. But one of the problems really has been that there's only four people in Parliament, National Party MPs, who stood in 2002, and that was Gerry Judith, Tim McIndoe and Nick Smith. So actually all the rest of them there have been on standing for a party that have been on a bit of an updraft, even the last election. So how do you handle an election where you're actually on the back foot? The other thing is very similar to 2002 was that there's a heck of a lot of split vote, and they must have been National Party people splitting their vote between voting one way for the candidate and another way for their party vote. And you don't see big changes in majorities like we did in Taranaki King Country and Rangitiki, for instance, and tip-outs like, for instance, Nelson. Mind you, Nelson, people have split their vote for a long time between Nick and Labour. But you don't see that unless people are disenchanted with their own party or a party they've previously supported. So I think you're quite right. Some of it is the environment around COVID and Jacinda mania, as it's been called, but also as Matt Doocy actually said, you know, if you don't look like you can manage your own stuff, how can you expect people to vote for you as a party to run government? And actually, unfortunately, National didn't look like it could manage its own household.
All right, just stay there, Richard. Ella, your thoughts?
I agree. I thought what was the interesting thing that Judith said was that, you know, it's time now to reflect and reconnect. And I think those are critical issues that the party is perhaps on the threshold of some big strategic thinking around what is its vision? How does it distinguish itself from what has become increasingly a broad church of Labour supporters? And that's going to take reflection. So I think it would be, I don't think it would be a great idea for the party to ditch her now by any means at all, that she is in fact going to be the caretaker while they go through the process and hopefully do emerge a better, stronger opposition, because every good, robust democracy needs a strong opposition.
Comments on those, Richard, and also in terms of Chester's point, reconnecting with the base. How does a major party go about reconnecting with its base?
Well, we'll find out, won't we? Because the National Party will need to do that. I entirely agree with the comments that both Ella and Chester have made. I think, and I'll be particularly interested in Chester's views on, you know, quite what it is that the National Party circa 2021 stands for. I think one of the challenges that it faces is that the Prime Minister has classed the political centre so close that there is just a little bit less oxygen, in fact, possibly quite a lot less oxygen for the National Party. It's been squeezed on that sort of centre-left by a very broad church, Labour Party, and then it's been squeezed on the right by a resurgent ACT Party. I mean, the resurgence there is almost entirely a function of disaffected National people drifting across to the right. So under other circumstances, as part of the project of renewal, you would anticipate that at least some of the ACT Party vote would come back to National in 2023, and you would expect some of the Labour Party's vote to come back to National in 2023. We've had some discussions, not today, but elsewhere, there's been discussion around the difference that 3 years made post-2022, which is a terrible result for National, and it came relatively close to taking office in 2005, 2002, 2005. But I think we're in a very different Aotearoa New Zealand at the moment. That result was largely a function of Don Brash's Orewa speech in a very divisive campaign. You know, you couldn't do that now. And in fact, I think the kind of lack of diversity, the lack of colour and the relative absence of women within the National Party's caucus is a really significant issue for it. You know, the membership of the parliament at the moment has around about 46, 47% of women. National Party have 11 women in their 35-member caucus. One of those more in queue might go, depending on how the specials fall. And I've read a couple of things that suggest that Labour will pick up a seat that National might drop. And so I think the National Party has some really quite significant challenges ahead of it, particularly in terms of its use of the party list. You know, we watched a number of their MPs of colour, to use a broad term, Pacific people, Māori MPs, just drop out of the House, in part because they were placed so far down the list that people like Jerry Brown and Nick Smith take up positions that the National Party might want to use in a little slightly more constructive fashion going forward. So there are some significant challenges around turning ship around. I think.
What's your thoughts there, Ella first?
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. I mean, New Zealand is such a culturally diverse population now that the parties that represent that diversity, we can see now, are well represented, even in ACT. I do think that is something the party will have to consider very seriously, how they address that.
In terms of Chester, that's such a challenge, isn't it? In terms of the new look or new brand or new feel National, what might that look like further?
Well, funnily enough, I think it's going to have to go back and start looking a bit like the National Party about 10 years ago. When I got into Parliament on the back of that Orewa speech, which was absolutely atrocious. Nevertheless, that was the facts. But when they moved from Brash to Key, the first thing that John Key said was, we are not going to go back and argue against everything we've voted, or argue for everything we've sort of voted against, or sorry, the other way around. Basically, we need to come up with new policies. All those decisions around, in those times, it was early childhood education and it was student loans and working for families that National had voted against in opposition. It was pointless trying to campaign on losing all of those things, because actually the argument had been won. So he had to say, and what John Key did was take National and camp it in the middle, and there it remained all the way through until Simon Bridges came along. And then what happened then was National rushed off to secure its core when it didn't need to, because it was still polling around mid-40s, and it just needed to stay there by running off to the right to supposedly do the rhetoric of opposition, it allowed Labor to get right into the middle where they are firmly camped now, and it's going to take something quite significant to move that on. I think, but as far as representation goes, I think one thing they might have to look at is candidate selection, because in national, under the National Party rules, the local electorate has more say than anybody else, so they choose who they want. Oh. And you had some strange situations, like for instance in Palmerston North, they selected a 17-year-old boy who'd never cast a vote, and at that time he was selected wasn't eligible to vote in any election, and dumped two perfectly good tried and tested Maori women aspirants, one of them who was an MP.
Yeah.
Well, how ridiculous can that be?
A quick response, Richard.
I think Chess has landed on exactly the example that I would have used as well. I mean, Joe Hayes is gone anyway, but it's difficult to overstate the message that was sent to the constituency of Palmerston North when the local party made that particular choice. William Wood is a fine young person in some respects, and he may well have a long future in the party. But there was a very clear signal that was sent, not least of all to Joe Hayes, about the standing of the mana of Mana Wahine in the National Party when a 17-year-old boy is chosen as the party's candidate. We've heard, it's a slightly throwaway line, but it's true that there are fewer Māori the Nationals caucus than there are men called Chris, of whom there are three, depending on what happens with Shane Urechi in the Whangarei seats, and depending what happens with the specials, there might be even fewer Māori in the caucus. I think that that is simply not tenable for a political party in this country in 2021 not to have a kind of a sensible strategic approach to this. But the other challenge that they face, I think, is there are some shibboleths of New Zealand politics that have just gone out the door over the weekend. And one of them is that I think the National Party can no longer claim to have a monopoly over the voice of rural people, because that clearly is no longer the case. But neither can Labor be positioned as a party of, urban elites and Chardonnay swillers. So you have some quite fundamental shifts in the way we make sense of New Zealand politics, and those will need to be part of the National Party's review process, I'd imagine.
All right. Professor Richard Shaw from Massey University, thank you very much for that. And just briefly, on a more personal note, Chester, that today you get your silver platter, you make a short farewell speech, and then that's it in terms of your political career. It must be really, to put it mildly, bittersweet as you leave that board and going, oh, okay, so that's it.
It's devastating, and it's no surprise that there were tears. And you think of some people who have gone out not because they're of poor performance, and I can think a lot of those MPs who absolutely worked their butt off in seats, but they got the boot because of the tide. And a lot of the people who won the seat had no history in the seat. And you just sort of think, well, what's that about? It's not about hard work. It's not about reward for hard work. Having said that, politicians win and lose elections on exactly this system. So no one's asking them you to feel sorry for them, but it is pretty poignant and it's pretty solemn. You get a guy, someone like Tim McIndoe, who has stood in every MMP election and has worked incredibly hard in Hamilton West, dumped on the tide.
Brutal.
Yeah, and that it's just those Hamilton seats have always been bellwether. I didn't think they were going to be this election because he and David Bennett had worked incredibly hard. David Bennett has knocked on every door in his electorate five times at least.
The nature of politics, the nature of democracy.
It's a beast. It's a beast. And I was so not going to talk about it today. Darn it.
We want to sort of touch more on Māori politics after the headlines, actually. So do try and connect with politics a bit more. Someone says, but is the silver platter engraved? I'm not quite sure about that. It is. Okay.
If there's a lot of you going, it's a much smaller platter, so being able to pick your chime is good.
Right. Quite a bit of response about haunted houses too. Someone says, on haunted houses, why would you want to engage with someone else's psychosis? There is no evidence that consciousness exists independent of matter. There is evidence brain wasting disease shows inarguably that consciousness is a product of matter. Ghosts do not exist, says Stephen. It is 5:29. You're on the panel, RNZ National. It's time for headlines.